Hello, everybody. This is Clint Locklear with Trapping Radio. It's springtime. I know a lot of y'all are out chasing turkeys, and I think that's a pretty cool thing to do. I'll be honest with you, it's not something I do, and I almost enjoy not doing it enough because Carl and Chip cannot believe that I don't go turkey hunting. And the only main reason is when you show me that turkey's got bacon on it somewhere, I might get a little bit more interested. Just saying. But it's a cool time of the year to be an outdoorsman. I know a lot of y'all are getting your garden started. It's a great time to be catching some catfish. Bass are on the bed. It's just really good. You know, the old saying around here is you go bass fishing when the dogwoods bloom, and they're just now blooming. So just a great time to be an outdoorsman. We're going to have a show that's going to be talking more about trick sets for coyotes and mud cats. Not catfish, but actually cats in mud. And before we do, I got a couple of small topics I want to talk about. And one of them is, you know, I normally get, and I just had some, I worked out a deal with a gentleman today. He sent me some caster. And one of the things that normally happens when I talk to people that want to send in caster and trade it for products, which if you got caster, I'm willing to do, is how do you ship it? And I just want to cover this really quick because anytime you send glands guys to a dealer, make sure you know that they know what you're getting and be very honest and upfront with them. And most of the time it's going to work out just fine. So when you're talking with a dealer about selling glands, caster, skunk, whatever that is, just be very honest with what you have. And if you're the type of guy that tries to get over on other people, trust me, your name gets spread around really quick. And you couldn't sell anything to anybody after a while. And luckily, I normally don't have this problem. But I just want to let you know that because there's guys that try to do some squirrely stuff when it comes to glands. Like on coyote glands, what are you calling coyote glands? Is it just the anal glands? Is it the anal glands with 6 inches of gut? Is it feet pads and ear pads and you know, uterus and vaginas and testicles and foot pads and livers and spleens and all that? So, you know, one coyote's basically a half a gallon of glands. To some dealers, that's probably fine. To other dealers like me, I would send it back to you because the only thing I use is anal glands for booty call. So the other stuff, to me, I'm not paying for it if I'm not using it. But how do you ship this stuff? Rule number one, you ship it on a Monday. And the reason for that is it gets there without sitting over somewhere over a weekend. And I do know that there are certain parts of the country that they get mail almost every day. But when you get into more rural areas, you're going to have a problem a lot of times with it sitting around. So if you ship it on Monday, it'll get there before the weekend, you know, from most of the country from one to the other, and you don't have to worry about it sitting there. You need to, as the guy that's sending the glands, you know, either put it in 2 or 3 Ziploc bags, or you can vacuum pack them, or the way the gentleman did today, he sent several tubs like, you know, the butter tubs. He taped those up really good, which was fine. And you wrap paper around everything when it's frozen right before you take it to the post office. The more paper and the more insulation that you get, the more time you have before everything starts thawing out. And a lot of times, just from a couple of states away, the glands will be still frozen or partially frozen coming through the mail with just newspaper. And if you're not used to shipping, you can put a lot of glands in a large flat rate box, depending on how many you have and different things like that. There is guys that sell a lot of glands sometimes, and they actually ship it UPS in a 5-gallon bucket. And they tape the living snot out of the bucket. And so far, the few guys I've seen do that, there hasn't been any issues with that whatsoever. They just ship the bucket UPS. I think you'd go broke trying that with postal, but that's definitely one option. But the biggest thing is, let the guy that's buying it know, have you ground them? Are they dried? Are they green? Talking about caster. Are they mixed with glycerin or glycol, or did you add salt? Because to certain lure makers, some won't mind, some will go, I can't use it because of whatever reasons. I want glands that I buy personally just to be frozen. I want them completely unadulterated. And when I get them in, if it's like coyote glands, just so everybody knows, and some people get their feelings hurt by this, but it's just the way that it is. If you get a gallon, like in, you know, one of those white gallon jugs that you see everybody using in trapping, if you're taking coyote glands out, the anal glands out, and you throw it in there as you're skinning and you stick that in the freezer, which is a great thing to do, then the next night you pull that out, you throw some more glands in there and they freeze, and the next night you pour it in there. Well, when that gallon jug is full, that's not a gallon of glands. So just so everybody's on the same page, most people that buy glands, before they give a volume amount, they're going to thaw them out. And wherever that settles on that jug is going to be the amount that they're willing to pay. Because realistically, guys, that's all they're paying for is what's in that jug. They're not paying for the air, because when you drop glands in and they're sticking up different ways, they're not paying for all that space. They're paying for a gallon of glands. And you should expect that, because that is the agreement between you and the buyer. Not half a gallon with a half a gallon of air just because of the way that they fell in there. So just so you know, most guys are going to thaw out glands. Now, if it's by weight, it doesn't matter. So like what I do today is I've got a big bowl and I flop out all the casters into the bowl. And then I've got a scale that goes down to the tenth of an ounce. And I will set everything on there. I will tear out the actual bowl itself, so that's no longer a weight issue. And I will fill that up, and what it is what it is. And, you know, there are certain things. You know, you should have a price worked out or a trade worked out of what's going to happen before it, you know, because there's shipping cost involved. So, like the gentleman today, he sent in about $250 worth caster, and I sent him more lure than that was actually worth per dollar, just because I appreciate him sending it that in here to me. That's kind of how you do it. Ship it on a Monday, ship it frozen, pack it really good with newspaper, and, you know, it's even better if you can figure out, like our postal service here in Dunlap, the truck doesn't leave until 4 o'clock. That's the first truck that leaves every day. So if I was going to ship something to, say, Jeff, I would have it frozen in the freezer, packed up, everything ready to go. And about 3:30, I'd walk in the door and I would hand the box over to him. Now, you don't have to do that, but, you know, being a lure maker, I want to make sure they get there the best they can. Because casters are a weird thing. They will rot in whole casters, but if you grind them, they don't. It's just, there's just weird things that happen. Cow glands, badger glands, otter glands, stuff like that, they can rot really quick. So, you know, if it's, sometimes it's better to ship those in the winter than it is the summer. You know, there's a lot of extra money to be made selling glands. There's a lot of extra money being, I've got some more glands coming, I think, next week. Caster. I think I've got some skunk coming too, if the guy sends it. You know, skunk needs to be where if they drop the box, it don't break. It needs to be very padded up. And an easy way on the bottle stuff like the skunk, as far as you don't get spillage, is steal some Saran wrap out of your kitchen while your wife's not looking, and Saran wrap that from the bottom to the top, and just go, keep going around and keep going around and keep going around, and then kind of squish it all together and keep going around. You'll make a plastic Saran wrap mold. I learned this from Alan at Hilltop, that even if it does leak, it can't get out of the plastic. And then you would put that in and you know, wrap that up really good with bubble wrap or paper, put that in a very sturdy box where it's not going to be jerking around, and it's probably going to be good to go. A lot of people will ship skunk in old ammo cans just because they think it helps on the smell. The only way I've personally been able to ship stuff with skunk in it and the post office not know about it is a thing that you can get from Uline that's called Mylar bags. They're actually aluminum foil bags. And you can seal them. You can get them where you can seal them with heat, or they've got little Ziplocs. Normally what I do is I will get all the air out of it I can, and I will Gorilla tape that thing. so there's no way that it comes open. And very little of the skunk essence, probably no more than a good call lure, is going to come out of 12, 15 ounces of skunk if you use it inside of that Mylar. Then I would do the Saran wrap and go about it that way. So I just thought I'd share that a little bit because, you know, a lot of y'all guys are finishing putting up your fur and you're looking at some actual value that's sitting in your freezer and you're wondering about how to get rid of them. You know, the best thing to do is just email or call some guys that actually make lure. And they'll let you know if they need it or not, or they're building up inventory and different things like that. So just good to know. I want to mention that the NTA is electing a new president at the NTA this year. Guys, I'm here to tell you, if you want to have a guy that actually gets stuff done for trapping, it's John Daniels. Now, someone's running against him, and the name did not register. I probably know him just because I've been to so many conventions. I don't have anything negative to say about the other guy. It's not that it's a negative type thing. I've heard rumors that the good old boys club in the NTA is trying to play some games where they kind of hurt John's reputation. And I'm going to talk to him about that. And if that's true, I want to expose that, because just like Trump did in Washington, the good old boys club, nothing ever good comes out of it. And he's not part of that. But if he does just a tenth of what he's done in Tennessee for the NTA, be a tremendous difference. So if you're not a member of the NTA and you want to have somebody in charge, go and get your membership and vote for John Daniels. I would be shocked if we're not happy with what he does. So I want to say that. And then I want to thank our sponsors. We have great sponsors. They're well known throughout the trapping industry because of their reputations. They don't, you know, let you send in money, then they sit on your money and they go on vacation and, you know, then they come back and then they're busy. And there's a lot of that going on in the trapping industry. I will not have a sponsor that treats people that way. And the guys that I have a sponsor do not treat people that way. Like when you order something from me, before Alan started shipping for me, if you ordered it on a Monday at 2:00, it would be in the mail on Tuesday that next day. So it's leaving my shop. That was my goal, unless I was out of town or something, within 24 hours to ship it. Most of the guys that are sponsors, they're shipping it the way that they're set up because of their volume. They're shipping that to you guys normally on the same day, if not in a couple of hours. They're set up in a more efficient fashion. They have people that are dedicated to packing orders. And if, you know, they're really good. They're not letting you send in, you know, money. Then 6 months later, you're screaming at people trying to figure out where your product's at. That's not the sponsors. We have great ones. We have Oki Kegel and Trap out of Oklahoma, which is Jeb. We got F&T Fur Harvesters out of Alpena, and great guys. We have Hilltop Outdoors, which is also Funky Trap Tags and Supplies, which is Alan Sayer out of Iowa. He's the one that actually I trust enough to ship out my products. And we have Wildlife Control out of Connecticut. And Dunlap Lures, which is a friend of mine, Jeff Dunlap. Now, Jeff does not ship his own. F&T ships his for him. So if you order something that's Jeff's, it's coming with the same speed and everything that comes out of F&T. So that's just pretty good. So support the sponsors and support if you like listening to Trapping Radio, because they're the one that pays the bills on server costs and everything like that. Now, I want the word of the day to be sous vide. Kind of sounds like a Frenchy French name. Sous vide is a Frenchy French name. And the reason I want to bring this up, Tim, a meat trapper, said that I should talk about this a little bit, because this is a form of cooking that is freaking awesome. It is unbelievable what it does to meat. Now, I know there's people that cook eggs and all kind of stuff in a sous vide. And it's spelled, by the way, S-O-U-S-V-I-D-E. Remember, it's French. It's not English. Sous vide is S-O-U-S-V-I-D-E. And if you just Google sous vide cooking, you will see what this is. It's a very simple process. But what it does, guys, especially for wild game, it makes you seem, when you cook, like a rock star. And here's what I mean by that. You can take all except maybe some of the best Wagyu or Kobe beef in the country, and you can get some really good stuff. Not that quality. We're not talking, $100 a pound stuff. But really good beef, tenderloins and backstrap, filet mignons. And if you've ever had that cooked right, you really aren't chewing it like you will regular meat. I'm not going to say it melts, in your mouth like butter, because that's not exactly true. But it's not a texture that you've got to sit there and chew on it like a roast, if you follow what I'm saying. Really, really good beef. And then when you get into wild game, which I know that most of y'all out there that listen to this show, you hunt, you fish, you trap. You're like the holy trinity of what is great about America. And you probably shoot some deer. If you're lucky enough to be around some wild hogs, you're trapping some beaver and some bobcats. If you're around elk, if you're around mountain lions, if you're, all the stuff that outdoorsmen have a chance, plus all of the fish. If you're around somewhere like when I was in Alaska with all the salmon we ate, I wish I'd have had a sous vide then. Trout, catfish. I haven't tried crappie or bream or anything like that in it yet. We've done king mackerel that I catch down in Florida. I wish I had some more shark left just to test that out on that, but I'm sure I will later this spring or this fall. So anything that an outdoorsman's got, duck, oh my gosh, duck is good. Totally change your view of duck if you put it in a sous vide. Pork, beef, chicken, doesn't make what it is. But I know most of y'all, we all eat, but most of y'all, probably get game in different ways. And the problem of a lot of that game is, like wild hogs is so lean that there's like a time period on wild hogs, especially the tenderloins, that you go from delicious to shoe leather in about 3 seconds. Because you want to get it up to temperature because of trichinosis. And then you don't want it to be dry. And it's really hard because it's so freaking lean. It doesn't have fat in it like the roasts do. It doesn't have fat in it the way a ribeye does. Or sirloin or something like that. It is like the leanest meat. It's way leaner than chicken. It's way leaner than turkey. It may be except for wild turkey. Which I can imagine if Carl or Chip or one of y'all try this with wild turkey, you'll be amazed at the texture because of what it does to duck. But it'll turn a deer backstrap into the texture of a $70, some of the best filet mignon that you can eat. That's an average deer. I cannot wait till this fall while I get to put some elk in the sous vide. I can't wait because I'm going out to Wyoming. What it is seems weird, and it's not very, it's becoming more common because of all the cooking shows and stuff like that. But when you, I'm sure, a lot of guys don't like spending a lot of money and going out to eat. They think they can cook at home, and I get that. But me and my wife, if you've ever been to a restaurant and you've had chicken or beef, or pork, and you put it in your mouth, and it almost melts, and you're like going, oh my God, how did they do this? It's a sous vide. So the principle of this thing is pretty simple. It is a heated water bath. And you can go to Amazon, and you can get one like I have that looks kind of like a crock pot. If I remember right, it was $225. I bought a good one. I like to eat. I didn't want to have a bad taste in my mouth from a sous vide by getting a cheap one. But a cheap one may work fine. And you can get them a lot cheaper than that. And they have these where you can put them in a crock pot, and it looks kind of like a warm thing. And you'll see that more on Amazon than you will the complete units. I've got the complete unit. I'm sure the other one works fine. I just know restaurants use more of the complete unit ones than they do what I consider the little wands. You stick it down in water in a pail or in a crock pot or something, and it heats the water. So what this thing does is you fill it up with water. You take your meat, because it's what I had for lunch today, was deer backstrap. And I cut the silver skin off, and then I cut the tenderloin down the middle, and I put the sous vide, put water in the sous vide. I preheat it to 131 degrees. Then I get regular Ziploc bags. You don't have to have special Ziploc bags. I put a pepper on the meat. I go pull some rosemary out of the garden. I put a sprig of rosemary in each one of those. And then I take the top of the bag and I run it almost to the end, about a finger's length. And I will stick it in the water before it gets hot, and I will just think of a bathing suit. You know, you get in a, you got a floppy bathing suit, and you get in the pool, and it sucks up next to you. Well, that's what you're going to do with a Ziploc bag and your meat, and you stick it down in there slowly, and the air will come out, and then you zip tie the rest of it and just let it float around in there. So I've got a crock pot looking thing that looks like it's full of water. And then on a the way that I cook, on the amount of when I eat lunch, it's about a pound and a half of meat. So I portion out the tenderloins to be that way. So I'll have four bags, about a quarter, a little bit more pound of tenderloin in each bag with the rosemary and the pepper. I Ziploc, get the air out, I leave it in there. It takes, now the water never gets above 131 degrees. See, this is why this is such a different technique than putting it in the oven or putting it in a pan or putting it on the grill. There's no chance for it to ever dry out because it's in a bag surrounded by water. And it's complete control of the situation. Beaver hams in this, you won't believe the texture. You'll think you're eating prime rib. I will cook that for my particular 131 degrees. I like them to be pretty much medium rare is what I like to have deer meat. I don't like overcooking it. And it'll take an hour and 40 minutes at 131 degrees. And all I do is when I drop those bags in there, it's got a timer. I'll set it for the time and the temperature, and I walk away. So when I come back for lunch, I take the bags out, I flip them over on a plate. Deer looks like liver when you put it in a sous vide. If you want to have the texture that you're used to getting, you can sear it really, really quick and really, really hot in a pan, and you would never know it was in a sous vide, except the quality of the texture of the meat is something that'll blow your mind. So if you want to like freak out your wife or friends, cook some wild game in a sous vide. And they're going to be thinking it's tough, and they're, you know, it's going to be this, that, and the other. Oh, it will rock your world on the actual texture. Because the deer that I had today, I could have cut with a butter knife, and I don't even think you need very many teeth to eat it. Flavor was amazing. And then when it comes out, I didn't sear it. I have before. I like doing the backstrap on the pork that way. I'll put some seasoning on there, some stuff Cindy makes. I don't know what it is. And then I'll sear that. I'm talking like 20 seconds on each side, and you'll think that it's been on a grill for just like every other pork chop, except it's full of moisture and it's tender. So if you're having trouble with wild game or just cooking in general, or if you want to like treat your wife to, you don't have to cook tonight type thing, or I'll get the meat or whatever, try sous vide, guys. You will think, or everybody else will think, that you've been to culinary school. It's very popular in Europe. It's not that popular here. I think it's going to become more popular. you know, it's just one of those things. Salmon and trout in that, you might as well, you'll think, your mouthfeel will think that you're eating butter. It is off the charts. But that's a sous vide. That's how easy it is to use. You can get all kind of recipes online. The one that we came had, it came with a little book, and it has, if you want to do roast or this or that other. Big cuts of meat take a long time, so I don't do like roast in this thing. Because that's like 20 hours. But you got to think, the temperature's only getting 140 degrees. Like right now, I've got two big old chuck roasts in my smoker at 250 for 6 hours, which will be done here by the time I get done doing the show. So that is the cool thing about this, that it makes it so easy. So that's a sous vide if you're interested. Let's get in. This is probably going to be a two-part show just because I don't want to rush these sets, because I think I need to describe these in a way that you'll understand them. And when I say trick sets, they're sets that, I'm not sure trick is the right way, but it's for coyotes and cats in the mud. I use these when the opportunity arises. It's not something that I use on a mass scale. So like if I'm going somewhere to catch a bunch of coyotes for fur, or the first round through a predator control group, you know, type situation for a job, I'm going to start out with more traditional, you know, dirt holes, flat sets, stuff like that, and I'll get the cream off of there. But if you ever get in a situation where you got some coyotes that you see around your sets, but they will just not play the game, these are some of the sets that I've learned that has a better chance of picking up those ones that are just reluctant. Because coyotes are coyotes, and I don't do a lot of shows about individual sets. I think the mindset of the trapper is more important. I think the theories behind trapping are more important than the actual set itself. But these are a little bit different. All these are ones that I've used a lot. A lot of the stuff that I've tried did not work. But these are very consistent. Now, you can run a whole line like this. If you wanted to run these type sets, you know, they're slower to put in sometimes than other type sets. You've got to be more particular where you're putting them, just which you'll figure out as we go along. But they're designed more for coyotes that just don't want to play the regular game. And coyotes are individuals. There's a lot of coyotes out there that are smarter, it seems like. They have a higher instinct of survival, and they just don't trust things as much. And that's probably the reason they're older, is the reason that they haven't been shot or trapped already. And if you have a female coyote, for an example, that you have somebody that's very sloppy, very unnatural, they go through an area, they educate that female. That female, I do believe, will actually teach the pups to stay away from certain things. Just like they found out that they had to switch up how they use poisons, because a female cow can raise a whole litter of pups and none of them will touch the poison after a while, because the surviving females will teach the pups. I think the same thing happens with traps. So that's when I use stuff like this. It's normally not my go-to, because the majority of coyotes that you're going to be after, guys, will be caught just fine with a dirt hole, a flat set, a mafia set, snares, stuff like that. But if you play this game long enough, especially if you get in the predator control side of this, oh, you're going to have some coyotes that will pull your hair out, just like some beaver will cause you to pull your hair out. And that's where these sets come come into play more than anything else. But I want to talk first, and this won't take that long, but it's just since I was in this mindset when I was prepping for the show, I want to talk a couple things about cats. Cats are cats. Cats are just like your house cats. Cats do not like being in sloppy mud. That's not their thing. They don't like being up to their ankles in slop, just like your house cat. But we trap in the winter. And if you were anywhere in the South this winter, It was a sloppy freaking mess. I mean, sloppy mess. And you're going to, after you make a catch, or if you're in a place that doesn't have a lot of grass cover and stuff like that, you're dealing with a lot of mud, and the cat does not want to play in the mud. So here's a couple of things that I've learned over the years. The first one is not going to be applicable to some of you that's listening, because it's a more of a regional type thing. Like, I don't know, but I doubt Colorado is going to be able to use this the way that we can in Tennessee and the Appalachian Mountains, or the way that you can use it in Oregon or up in Maine and places. If it's a desert type environment, I don't know if you're going to find something like this very easy. But there's a couple of things that you can do that maybe mimic it. I've never done it, but I'm going to mention what I think could be done. So what I do here in the mountains, if it starts getting really, really, really sloppy, I got my eyes open all the time. And when I find a lot of rocks and a lot of places that's in shade a lot, moss grows here like crazy. Not like it does out in Oregon and Seattle and places, but it grows here pretty good. And, you know, that's a living plant that stays, in form the whole season. So what I'll do, if I'm building my, you know, my chute type set or a cubby or something like that, I'm going to use my two traps. I'm going to have the same blocking that we've talked about before. I'm going to be doing all that type stuff. But I want to give the cat an option to stay out of the mud. So what I will do is I'll take a flat shovel and I will scoop up a bunch of that moss, and I will give him kind of like a runway going into where I want him to go inside of the set. When I get close to the set, what I will do then is I will cut with a pocket knife that moss that will fit just inside of the jaws. Not over the jaws, because it can clog traps up, but where it sits inside of the jaw. Basically what I'm doing is the same thing that guys that make spring hole sets do when they put the grass and stuff on top of the trap. So the grass is just above the water and the trap's just below the water, and the animal steps, because they don't want to get in the water when it's cold. They step on the grass, it falls down through the pan and he catches them. That's exactly what I do in mud. But you got to be paying attention where your moss is at, because you got to, you know, keep it in mind, so when you need it, you know where some's at. It doesn't hold together that well in a truck. Like, it's not something you can throw in your truck and use 2 weeks from now. It'll just beat itself to death. So, you know, that's why you got to have your eyes open. You got to be paying attention. So I will put out a lot of this moss off a trail and stuff that's not that muddy, where I think a cat's going to be. And I'll give him a runway of moss broken up, because he'll just hopscotch over there on that, because that's what cats do. And it's so wild when you catch a cat. You can see they went from moss to moss because there's no tracks whatsoever. And then they get caught on a drag and they go, you know, back behind the set. And you can see they didn't step on anything but the moss. And then when I get to the trap or traps that's close up to the set, I cut that out. So if it's a 6-inch trap, it's going to be, you know, probably 5.5 inches. And I'm not putting any dirt or anything around the pan. I just kind of halfway cover up the levers and everything. I don't spend a lot of time. Cats don't care. And I will set that moss down once it's bedded right on top. And it's like this beautiful, come here, please step right here, because it's dry, it's soft, it's quiet. It's everything a cat likes. And when they step on that moss, they're yours. If it's really, really thick moss, you'll need to up your pan tension. A lot of the moss that I can get off rocks in younger type moss places, I don't have to worry about that. But there's some moss that grows pretty freaking dense. So you'll need to think about your pan tension, possibly. Now, that's one thing I do for mud cats. The other thing is what I call a bridge or a road. So if I'm building my type cat set, which you can go and look up on YouTube, and you can see exactly how I do it, because I'm pretty basic when it comes to this. There's a lot of rules to that set, but they're there for a reason, guys. They really are. And if you kind of follow the rules, you can do whatever you want, but as long as you follow the rules of the set. Well, if you think about my shoot of a cat set's no wider than 7.5-8 inches. That's it. That's as wide as I want them to be able to get to the set. My traps are 18 inches, 20 inches back. If cats are high, I'm using two traps. I think you're foolish if you don't. You can let your ego be your ego, but I'd rather make the money. That's just me. You can do whatever you want to do. It's a free country. But if it's one or two traps, it's irrelevant. So what I will do, if I know it's muddy and I know we're getting a bunch of rain, I will actually take my digging hammer or my shovel or my mattock, depending on what type of ground it is, and everywhere but it's right in front of that chute, I will dig down 3 or 4 inches and leave all of that loose dirt. So what's going to happen when it gets wet? It's going to be a nasty mess. No cat's going to want to step in. If I have to, I can bring in some dry dirt and raise up the natural ground a couple inches. It does not matter to a cat. And I, you know, a couple of 5-gallon buckets of that for, you know, when cats are 60, 80, 100 bucks, that's not that big a deal. And sometimes I'll have this chute, you know, 4 or 5 feet long going up to the traps. But what's interesting, again, when you use drags, you can see what the cats do. So you get rain, you've got a high runway, basically. You got your traps in the normal position, that's higher too. So all the water's running off everything that you have. It's gonna stay drier, and the cat's gonna see all the sloppiness on both sides because you dug it out and just left it there, so it's gonna turn into this muck. But you've got this harder runway that looks drier because it is, and the cat, just like you put him on a string, goes right down that runway because it's drier and gets right where you want him to be because everywhere else is in muck. Maybe in a desert environment, not something you got to worry about. Most of us in the Northeast and the South and the Midwest, that's something we better worry about because it's coming. It's going to rain and it's going to screw you up. So that's two things that I do for mud cats that I thought I would share with everybody about what that is. So we're going to get into some of the coyotes. Now, the first one is, this is an old woofer type set. Some of the James Mass, the books that he's written, you can see sets like this, some of his old letters that I saw up at Tom Parr's Trap Museum where he's explaining this to the other trappers. Weberly, the gentleman down in Texas that actually designed the Weberly High Plains Prowl that O'Gorman makes, he's a predator guy, or at least he used to be, down in Texas. They had an unusual way that both of these guys, one was from California and one was from Texas, and I think he used to trap, I think Weberly actually trapped a lot in Wyoming and Montana. But they have this a set, and I don't know what they call it, so I'm just going to call it a whole triple because it can be inverted either way. But it's a simple concept. So if you were to take, and both of these guys didn't do really big dirt holes, this is a crazy natural set as long as you know how to blend a set in. And they will take and they will make a mouse hole like in the middle of the road, two tracks. Wimberly was famous for this. He wouldn't get off the side of the road because the coyotes were in the road, so he'd set the dang thing in the middle of where people drove, right there. There's nothing to see on this set, so it's not like you're going to have theft problems unless you got a coyote bouncing in it. Puts a mouse hole in, you know, as deep as you can get it. He lures and baits it, so whatever you want to use, you could, you know, throw some Federales and some hammer or some coyote claymore down in there. Whatever you want to use, GH2, something from Craig, I don't care what you use, just whatever your normal principle is. Put that in that. It's one hole. It's not very big. It's about the size of, you know, 5/8 rebar if you were to shove that in the ground and ream it out. That's all it is. And then they either did one or two things for this set. Now, these are older trappers that catch way more coyotes than anybody else does today that I know of. We're talking hundreds and hundreds and hundreds, sometimes 1,000. And this was one of their main sets, especially Wimberley down in Texas. In the right in the dead middle of the two track, and you can do this off to the side, you can do it on the edge of a field, he puts his mouse hole, he does his lure and his bait, and then he makes a triangle of traps. See, this is very old school. It's extremely deadly. Now, I know there's some states that you can't have traps so close to each other. You need to go to a different state. But, you know, for everybody else, this will work. I like using drags because I have caught doubles on a single set with this set right here. So I put a punch hole in the middle of the road or where I know cows are going to be going. And then I will just make a triangle. Where they're at, guys, is not that important. You want them to be somewhere. These guys set them more about 9 to 10 inches away from the hole. I like 12. It doesn't seem to matter. And they just make a triangle. So if you put a hole on a piece of paper, go up above the hole a little bit and go 12 inches for, or 10 inches, whatever you want to do from the hole, but just make a triangle around them. Then you blend everything back in like it's not there. If you're in grass, use grass. If you're in leaves, use leaves. If you've got dry dirt and the dirt around it's dry, then you will blend it in with dirt. The goal here is not to have anything showing of a pattern. Both of these guys believed in this heavily. And I think there's a reason for it, because they caught more coyotes this way. I know that goes against the fox mindset that we've all learned from, from the guys that we think of today from the last fur boom. You know, the pattern, you know, the sweet spots, the bigger patterns, whatever it is. A lot of the real wolfers, they didn't really like patterns. That's a fox thing more than a coyote thing. So basically, you just got a hole that's punched in the middle of the road, and you got three traps. And however you want to move your triangle around that thing, it don't matter if there are two on the bottom and one up top or northeast, southwest, didn't make any difference. But they blend those traps in off of that hole. Mass staked, Wimberley drug. I like to drag because you can catch doubles off of this. It's all blended in. Now think about in your mind what's happening with a coyote. He's coming down the road, one of the other tracks. Right there where he's normally going, where he normally does not come in contact with other trap sets because they're just off to the side. And I do think coyotes can pick up on patterns like that. He smells something, but he doesn't really see anything. And any foot pattern at all that he's going to work that hole, he's got three little minefields he's got to get around. Now, since it's a small hole, and it's, 6, 8, 9 inches deep. Everything's at the bottom of that hole. He's got to dig the hole out for this to work, for him to be able to get the bait or lure. He can't really roll on it because it's completely underground. Do not, let me say this again, do not put your lure at the rim of the hole. Especially on a set like this, it's completely flat and hidden. They're going to roll on it. They're going to snap your traps off. That's not what you want. As he works that set, he's going to find those traps. Now, I know that there's people that think they know where a coyote's going to step. And all I can say to that is one big letter starts with a B and the other one starts with a big S. That is crap. Nobody knows where a coyote's going to step. Anybody that thinks they do is delusional. Your angle of your hole has no variance on that whatsoever. I hate to bust your bubble if you believe that. You've obviously not looked at a lot of trail cam footage and night vision footage. They all act different. Some come in brave, some come in scared, some come in fast, some come in slow. Adult coyotes don't act like pup coyotes. So unless you know exactly what's coming, the saying that you know where they're going to step doesn't matter. So don't freak out over this set because you think that you got to have a little pebble here to block him, or it's at a certain formula away from it. Don't worry about any of that. If he works that set, he's going to find one of those traps. Deadly, deadly set. Now, the reverse of this, because it's a whole triple, is what I'm calling it. It's just what I've called it. Not that creative on everything. Is a complete inverted of that set. So you go to the road or wherever your trail is or wherever you're going to put your set at. You bed the trap rock solid. You blend the set in to the point, except for your final dusting, that you will not be able to see the trap is there. And this is an art form. Don't get frustrated if you're new at trapping and you're trying to blend traps and it looks like Godzilla tried to do it. Guys, that's what everybody went through when they started learning how to trap. That's just life. It takes a skill set, it takes muscle memory, and there's a lot of this that's it's just what it is. So you gotta practice. So when you watch somebody that's done a lot of flat sets and they just make thing goes poof and they disappear, that's because they've got hundreds and hundreds of hours in doing that. So you're gonna have to work on it a little bit more. You know, you don't want to disturb a lot of ground. You know, if you're doing sets like this, you know, going back to some of the stuff we've talked about where maybe a kneeling cloth is not a bad idea. Maybe a great big old foam pad that you can put the dirt up on is not really a bad idea for particular sets like this. But you bed the set all except for your final dusting just so you know where the trap is at, and you're inverting the traps for the hole at this point. So then you'll go, you know, 9, 10, 12 inches away from that trap, make a triangle again from the trap, and you're going to put in three different mouse holes with your re-rod or your stake setter, whatever you're using, and you use a different lure in each one, or bait, lure, gland lure, whatever turns you on. The foot traffic at that set is pretty tremendous. Because it's kind of like we've all heard, you know, like when you see people at a circus and they're dealing with a lion, they can get a chair out there and it's got four legs and the lion don't know which one to actually start swatting at because there's four of them. You stick one club out there in front of him, he's going to take it away from you and take your head off. The four confuses the lion. At least that's what I've always been told. Probably a myth, but it makes sense and it works for this particular example. When you have those three different holes and they're spread, you know, 9 to 12 inches away from your trap, it's not like one single thing that he's focused on. So you get foot movement. The interesting placement, the genius of this set is the trap's in line with the other holes with the inside foot. So as he goes, he digs out a set from the outside, it's completely safe. So he comes up to the set, say you've got a hole on the north side and a hole on the south side and a hole on the east or west side, whatever. But you're going to make a triangle, so that wouldn't really work. But you'll see it on paper. When he digs that hole, he comes up in contact with it, he digs it out. There's no trap there to catch the coyote. When he goes to the other hole, he's in trouble. The only way a coyote's going to survive this, really, is to back up and go around and repeat that process. But once the coyote realizes there's not a danger there, because he dug the hole up and nothing bad happened, but just a foot away would be 2 foot away. There's another intriguing smell. And then right over there, another 2 foot away, there's another intriguing smell. And nothing happened with this at all. He'll go from hole to hole digging it out. Again, guys, do not put your lure at the top of the hole. He's going to roll on it and snap your trap off. Genius, genius set. Now, this is a set I remember where I first tried this. It was up on Signal Mountain. It was a land trust. It's kind of a crazy deal what rich people do. But this guy bought this property, and it was something like 10,000 acres up behind Signal Mountain. Signal Mountain is an expensive place. Taxes on that must have been crazy. So this guy went and he talked to TWRA, which is our version of DNR, or somebody in a government organization like USDA. I don't know who actually does a program like this, but for not paying taxes on it for 100 years, after 100 years, because he was already 70, his kids would have been too old to use it at that point, the state will take that over and turn it into a wildlife management area. That's the deal. No taxes for 100 years. And they get the property when it's said and done, because it's expensive property. But I remember being up there, and it was actually dry. It was in the middle of the summer. It was hot. And I went through there and did very well on coyotes with standard dirt holes and flat sets. But there was like 4 or 5 tracks. And after you spend enough time on a piece of property and you're seeing the same tracks, you're not absolutely sure it's the same coyote, but a lot of times it's pretty close. So you went in, and after doing the normal stuff, what I did is I put a hole in the ground. I had one of those, I think they're called a badger or groundhog. And it's it's about an inch and a half pipe, inch and a quarter. It's got a little shovel thing on one side and a hammer thing on the other. So I dug a hole down about 10, 12 inches with that thing, because you could turn it, you know, and kind of dig it out at the same time. So that's what I did. Now, I was trying to figure out, because at this particular time, and this was probably 17, 18 years ago, that I decided from a lot of the studying that I was doing that coyotes like to walk on unaffected ground. So I was playing, I had that in my head. And I went and I put the hole in straight down. And then I kept about a 6.5-7 inch swath for me to put the trap. And I didn't dig that up, but I took my mattock or my fireman's tool, and I made a 3-foot circle all except for where I knew I was just going to leave the trap. So I dug, if you can think about digging a whole circle around the dirt hole for dirt pattern, and then there was a 6-inch section out to that 3-inch dug up hole. So it's a circle 3 feet around that thing. And I just left it all nasty and loose and dug it up. I mean, I didn't spend a whole lot of time, but I just made it really rough. But on this one little section that was 6.5-7 inches, because I remember the first time I used this, I was using a No. 3 Canadian modified old style Bridger trap on a stake. I put the trap in about 12 inches back away from that hole, on the place that I didn't dig up. So it's just like if you were just to dig that whole circle, then come in and smooth one straight path to the hole, and it looks level and looks like it hadn't been disturbed. That's all this is. 12 inches back, I bedded the trap. I had lots of dry dirt, because it was in the summer, and I blended that particular place where it looks like it was always, it's never been dug up by anything. And it was just an experiment. I have no doubt I'm not the first person in history to try this. I've never seen anybody else do this. But this was after I went and caught all the coyotes, you know, majority of the coyotes doing other things. And I was getting very desperate to get these off, because the old man that had the property would run around on his little golf cart, and if he saw a coyote track, it just stressed him out. Then he would stress me out, because he was paying me. He just assumed that a trapper could go in a couple of days and catch every coyote on 10,000 acres. So I've got the hole. It's all torn up except for seven inches probably going out to the edge of the circle. So what it looks like is an animal's digging at the hole and they just didn't get everything. It kind of looks like a burn circle. There's bait and lure. I don't remember what I put in there. But there's bait and lure at the bottom of the hole. Traps 12 inches off inside of that chute. And sure enough, the next morning I had a huge old coyote with teeth that were worn down to look like little circles. I was blown away. I was ecstatic. Now, you know, I was using the stakes, so that set was destroyed. So I went down like 50, 60 yards to where, because whatever was going on, there was two that were traveling together off and on. So I went down 50 or 60 yards on the same little two track, and I repeated that process. 2 days later, I had an equally old, and actually she looks like she was in bad shape, female coyote. And I was like, wow. It is that effective. Here's the negative side of this set. In really muddy situations, it's hard to make that 7-inch lane look completely undisturbed. So if you're going to try to do this in the winter, which I've definitely done, I'm in a habit of going under bridges and under buildings and getting dry dirt. You go through a lot of it because you got to feather stuff out once you get outside of that lane so it looks natural. And it takes a lot of energy to put this set in because, you know, you're talking, the circle you're digging up is a 3 foot, you're digging a catch circle. So there's a lot of energy involved there. And it's not going to be something, because of the energy usage of this set, it's not something that I'm going to go out and put 100 of these things out. But when I need a set that I'm willing to spend more energy on for particular coyotes that are harder to catch than the standard dirt hole or flat set, this is a proven winner for me. I used it in New Mexico, just playing around. I've used it in Texas. I've used it in Missouri. I've used it in North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, Tennessee, Louisiana. Trying to think if there's any other place that pops in my head really quick that I know that I've used this. In Mississippi. It worked as good there as it did here. That's deserts to swamps to summer to winter. And if you're just running 10 or 12 traps and you want to put that much energy into them to dig that circle out so it really looks like something, I tore the world up. And it wasn't like a perfect circle on the outside. I mean, it was just rough everywhere except it's like whatever dug at this just missed a spot. Now see, there's a lesson here that I want you to just think about a little bit. If you've got a 3 foot circle of torn up dirt and the coyotes, I'm not using any sticks, any rocks, no blocking, no droppings, no nothing. There's nothing guiding that coyote. It's a completely flat set. He can come in from any direction. He chooses to enter the set by the undisturbed ground. Let that sink in for your more standard type sets. Maybe, because I can tell you it's true, you can use really rough dirt patterns as a guide. And they will choose the undisturbed ground most of the time. Not that I don't think that they think that there's a trap in the disturbed ground. I don't think they have that type of capacity. But walking on undisturbed ground just feels safer. It's smoother. That's what they walk on all the time. They're not walking on dirt patterns all the time. They're walking on natural ground. But this particular type set, and the next time I do this, I will try to remember to do a YouTube video on this. Because to me, it's a cool set. For one, the memory that I have behind it, the effectiveness of it, and it's worked in so many different places. And there's very few misses because you almost damn near have him in a blind set, basically, working the hole. I can only think of a few times that there were tracks in the disturbed dirt and I didn't make a catch. I'm not saying it's 100%. There's nothing 100% with coyotes. But the majority of them are standing in that trap when I get there. Of course, they're not standing right there anymore because I use drags. But they're standing somewhere close there. Fox, I've caught a tremendous amount of grays with this, and it's blown my mind. Because even in the summer, sometimes when I crank that pan tension up, you should be catching a gray fox, but somehow you still do. I've never really used it around red fox. I have a feeling to do the same thing. But is it worth the energy for a production set? Probably not. But for hard to catch coyotes, or hard to catch fox, I don't think it'd make a difference to a coon. It's just one of these things to stick in the back of your mind. Now, like I said, we've already been going for a little over an hour, so I'm going to do a part two of this show where I'm going to go into some other sets that I've learned that can pick up coyotes. I don't like the word smart because I don't think that's true. I think that's misleading to even say. But their instincts are much higher. So when you're dealing with an animal that has much higher survival instincts, you have to do something besides the ordinary a lot of times. So we're going to cover the rest of the sets that I've got all these notes on next week. And I hope y'all have a good week. Like I said, if you're having trouble with your meat not being too moist, get you a sous vide. Everybody be wanting to know what your recipe is, but it's not the recipe. It's how you're cooking it. Y'all go have fun.